Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the championship round of the 6th annual policy debate hosted by the Abshire and Amori Leadership Academy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. These debates, inspired by the People Speak initiative of the UN Foundation, have grown in size and dynamic with each successive event. What began as a small competition among the young staff at CSIS has evolved into what awaits us this evening, the culmination of a multiple-round debate tournament involving four of Washington's leading think tanks, the Cato Institute, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Heritage Foundation, and the Hudson Institute. The debate about America's role in the world is not new. At crucial points throughout U.S. history, politicians have struggled with moral dilemmas about U.S. power and how it should be used to influence the world. Now, only 2 days before President Bush attends the APEC summit in China, it is time for young people to take the stage and debate America's role in the world. Tonight, young professionals living and working in the nation's capital will come together to debate various pressing and provocative issues that face American foreign policy in the context of U.S.-Sino relations. For tonight's final debate, you've heard two teams representing the CSIS and Cato will debate whether or not the U.S. should substantially increase diplomatic and economic pressure on the People's Republic of China to recognize the independence of Taiwan. This discussion of American foreign policy towards China and Taiwan comes at a critical juncture in world history. Many scholars believe China is on the rise to becoming the next great world power, and how the United States engages China now will most certainly shape our relationship and world politics for decades to come. Global policy decisions affect us all, but especially the young people who have come together tonight. Unlike domestic issues, foreign policy can be acted on only at a national level in Washington by our elected leaders. But foreign policy can and must be influenced by an informed and engaged citizenry. We have a stake in the future of this country and the consequences of decisions taken on our behalf. Our goal tonight is to come together as a community to give serious and purposeful consideration to the way this country defines its long-term interests, the priorities we establish among the threats and opportunities that we face, and the means that we are willing to use to rise to the challenges ahead. We hope that these debates will provoke you to engage in thoughtful discussions of your own American foreign policy. I would like to challenge each and every one of you to open up a dialogue with someone in your life, whether it's a friend or spouse or even a coworker, on an issue in foreign policy that resonates with you. Thank you for taking the time to come here tonight. Enjoy the debate. I know all the debaters worked so hard to make this happen. I would now like to ask Brian Patrick to come to the podium to introduce the debaters and judges for the championship round. Good luck, everyone.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. My name is Brian Patrick, and I'm an intern here at CSIS. I'm in the Homeland Security Program. I have also assisted in the research for the CSIS debate team and am one of the moderators for tonight's championship round. So far tonight, we have been present in front of some great debate on U.S. policy revolving around China and Taiwan. Further in this discussion in tonight's championship rounds, we have Jonas Popesco and Andrew Tabler representing CSIS arguing the affirmative, and opposite them, we have Jonathan Rick and Andrew Mellon of Cato arguing the negative. Tonight's judging will be done by all four judges from the previous rounds. We have David Barnes from the Heritage Foundation, Charles Horner from the Hudson Institute, Christopher Preble from the Cato Institute, and Bill Taylor from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The format for tonight's event will be as following. The first affirmative speaker will speak for 5 minutes. The negative's B speaker will then have 90 seconds to cross-examine the affirmative. The negative then comes up with their A speaker and will speak for 5 minutes. The first affirmative will then return back to the mic and have 90 seconds to cross-examine the negative speaker. The second affirmative will then have a 4-minute rebuttal, which will lastly be followed and close the debate with the negative's 4-minute rebuttal. After the negative's second rebuttal, the debate will close with a 10-minute question and answer session from the audience, with the audience free to ask questions for both the affirmative and the negative teams. Also, it should be noted that 3 minutes of preparatory time is allotted for both teams to use throughout the debate. I ask you all, the debaters also to be mindful of their preparatory time and pay attention to the moderators when time is called. You may finish your statement, but no more. I look forward to seeing the policies and arguments that these two teams have to offer. Good luck to both Cato and CSIS tonight.
Good evening, and again, welcome to CSIS. The affirmative will demonstrate that the status quo in the Taiwan Strait is unsustainable, and therefore the United States needs to act now to assure that the Taiwan solution will be a peaceful one. China's economic development is increasingly dependent on collaboration with the United States. This offers us great leverage. We should have them make a choice between their own development and Taiwan's movement towards independence. President Bush has called us prayer of freedom around the world, the calling of our time, the calling of our country. He should pressure China diplomatically to recognize the independence of Taiwan by using a series of speeches based on a defense of America's most cherished principles and values. First, the affirmative will present the increasingly divergent views of Taiwan's future coming from the Taiwanese leaders on the one hand and from the Chinese Communist Party on the other. Up until the 2000 elections, the pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party has never been in power. However, the DPP and pro-independence factions have had increasing electoral success throughout the 90s, which culminated with the victory and the rise to power of President Chen, who was also re-elected in 2004. This re-election campaign was widely viewed as a huge victory for the pro-independence movement, since the themes were highly nationalistic. As an example of the rhetoric used, President Chen said that Taiwan is an independent sovereign country that must reject the One China claim. An economist poll recently stated that over the past 12 years, the Taiwanese people consider themselves more Taiwanese, from 17% 12 years ago to 41% now, while they consider themselves Chinese, a decreasing number of 26% then and 6% now. On the Chinese side, the Communist Party has also been showing increasing signs of impatience with the status quo. What's more threatening, this talk of Taiwan reunification has been recently linked with the use of military force. The anti-secession law recently passed in March of this year says that China shall use military force against Taiwan whenever Chinese leadership decides that the possibilities for peaceful reunification have been exhausted. As further proof for China's threatening intentions regarding the Taiwan Strait, PLA's modernization and dramatic expansion over the past decade have been focused almost exclusively on the Taiwan Strait scenario. Rear Admiral Eric A. McVadden recently testified for the U.S.-China Commission that the Chinese concept for the use of force has become significantly clear and precisely directed, seeking a way to prevail in an attempt to regain Taiwan. The admiral also notes that China's modernization in cruise and ballistic missiles will soon make a U.S. defense of Taiwan extremely difficult, as Chinese recently have tested missiles that can hit United States carriers and military bases in the region. So given these two colliding trends in Taiwanese and Chinese views of the future of the island, it is high time for the United States to realize that maintaining the status quo is a ticking time bomb and to act before it's too late. The Communist Party hold on power is dependent on sustained economic growth. Its legitimacy and support comes mainly from assuring robust economic development. Chinese officials view economic stability as a key to their hold on power. But China's export-driven economy, its number one priority is heavily dependent on investment from U.S. companies and on access to U.S. markets. U.S. should threaten China with severely limiting the amounts U.S. firms can invest in China and with drastically restricting the access of Chinese goods to U.S. markets. To get a sense of just how important U.S. markets access and is for China, consider that the United States is China's main trading partner, with as much as a third of the Chinese exports coming to American markets. Moreover, the United States, along with its allies Japan and Taiwan, are the second, third, and fourth largest providers of foreign direct investment to China. It has been estimated that as much as 50% of Chinese GDP comes from exports from foreign companies. All in all, the U.S. should use this economic leverage to pressure China into backing down on the Taiwan issue, while on a diplomatic level, President Bush should more forcefully integrate Taiwan into his discourse regarding the spread of freedom around the world. As I said in the beginning, we should force China to make a choice between their own development and Taiwan's freedom. This is the most realistic way to solve the Taiwan's independence problem peacefully without the huge sacrifices brought upon by a looming military confrontation. The U.S. will have to deal with this problem in either case. It's up to us to deal with it now on our own terms or to let China become so strong that it can feel compelled to deal with it on its own terms. Thank you.
The negative cross-examination.
The first question we'd like to ask our opponents is, do you believe that a series of speeches by President Bush would meet the burden of the resolution where it says that you must substantially increase diplomatic and economic pressure? So you're saying that a series of speeches would not meet the burden of the resolution?
I'm saying that a series of speeches
using at the same time. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Both economic and diplomatic pressure need to be used simultaneously in order to have.
Okay. Thank you. You didn't meet the burden. Why will your policy end in peace? Do you deny that reunification will be bloody?
Excuse me, did you say that I did not meet the burden? I just said that economic and diplomatic pressure should be used simultaneously.
Next question. Do you deny that reunification will be bloody?
I don't know how the reunification is going to be.
You seem to downplay the importance of Taiwan. It seems that Taiwan is crucial to the Chinese. How important do you think Taiwan is to the Chinese?
I think Taiwan is important to the Chinese. I don't think I said otherwise.
If the status quo has been relatively stable for the last 50 or 60 years, then what reason is there that we have to act now?
Well, as I mentioned in my affirmative also, the DPP has never been in power so far, and now they are, and now they're talking about independence. And China has never been powerful enough to feel that it has a shot at unifying Taiwan by military force, and now they're increasingly getting to that point.
That's time, gentlemen.
International relations is not a game. It's not an academic exercise, and it's not about grandiose abstractions or righteous platitudes. International relations is a cost-benefit analysis. It's about national interests and spheres of influence. And yes, morality distinctly enters into the equation when death and destruction are very real factors. To wit, China's not fooling around when it comes to Taiwan. This much is incontestable. Its leaders mean it when they say that China is a part of Taiwan and that reunification, as polling data invariably confirm, is the will of the Chinese people. Why is Taiwan so important to China, you might ask? Beijing has invested its very identity in Taiwan. Its national destiny, its pride, its honor, and its rage are inextricably bound up with this little island. China's credibility is on the line here, so it would be willing to incur massive military and economic losses in order to save face. Indeed, Chinese officials have made veiled nuclear threats to the U.S. over Taiwan. In other words, as a Chinese general told an American diplomat in 1995, quote, "In the end, you," meaning Americans, "care more about Los Angeles than you do about Taipei." This is true. Ask any Chinese citizen what he thinks about Taiwan. And the overwhelming odds are that he'll respond with deep-seated passion. By stark contrast, ask an American what he thinks of Taiwan, and he'll respond with indifference. Moreover, when it comes to blood and treasure, Americans should be indifferent or strategically ambiguous. We should care more about our own lives and liberties than those of the Taiwanese. We should be, like all countries, self-interested. Given our enormous economic ties with China, Taiwan is comparatively unimportant. China is our third largest trading partner, accounting for 15% of all imports and exports. To put it another way, from clothing to computers, from the low end to the high end, you'd be hard put not to find those famous three little words, made in China. Our opponents want to pressure China, but they ignore the consequences of their provocations. China will respond with a vengeance in at least three ways: militarily, diplomatically, economically. Militarily, I want to emphasize that when China issues threats over Taiwan, it is not blustering. On the Taiwan question, the stakes could not be higher for Beijing. Indeed, Beijing has made it repeatedly explicit that it would launch a war, that it would launch a war if Taiwan were, quote, separated from China in any name. And it's not just any kind of war. It's a war between two nuclear-armed powers. Even operating on the assumption that we could win the war, it is reasonable to ask Americans, is it reasonable to ask Americans to sacrifice their lives, their liberties, and their wallets to defend the marginal benefits our opponents have outlined? Are you willing to sacrifice Los Angeles for Taipei? Diplomatically, we need China's cooperation in the United Nations, which includes not only voting with us, but also abstaining. As a permanent member of the Security Council, however, China can veto any resolution it wants. One example. We're in the middle of talks with North Korea regarding its nuclear ambitions. On this issue, China's regional influence is indispensable. So if we provoke her, she'll respond in kind and progress will cease. Economically, China would almost certainly slap us with tariffs and quotas, the effect of which would be increased prices for American consumers. It also behooves us to note that pressuring China will destabilize Taiwan. After all, prosperity requires stability. Stability gives investors the security to invest. In fact, past conflicts between China and Taiwan have caused volatility and uncertainty. In 1996, one example, the third Taiwan Strait crisis caused prices in the computer market to jump dramatically. In Kyoto today, President Bush called Taiwan, quote, free and democratic and prosperous. Our opponents bear the burden of justifying the significant risks they propose to change this status. Status quo isn't perfect, but it's been painstakingly, skillfully crafted over the past 60 years. Let's not turn statesmanship into brinksmanship. Thank you very much.
Time.
Okay. I'd like to ask my friend from the other team if I would be right to assume that you think a war with China would be something dreadful that should be avoided.
Of course, it's war. Thank you.
No. Because that was my entire point in making this case for diplomatic and economic pressures. Avoid a war.
But the problem
Next
is those
question.
Diplomatic and economic pressures would cause a war.
You've mentioned that China would retaliate against us economically by putting quotas and tariffs on their own goods.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, that's a question. Did you mention that?
Yes.
Okay, well, so far the negotiations have been the other way around because China's economic development is based on exporting goods. So why would they do that, and wouldn't that hurt them much more than that would hurt the United States consumer that would have to pay, like, maybe, I don't know, $11 for a T-shirt?
The reason that they would do this is because they are willing to incur more pain over this than we are, quite simply. They care more about Taiwan than we do, so they're willing to chop off their leg if it means that they're chopping off our foot in the meantime.
And do you think that if you get to a situation of war in Taiwan, that would be their way of convincing the U.S. of not supporting Taiwan, making goods more expensive?
I certainly think that that would be part of the case. I doubt that they would limit their options.
That's time, gentlemen.
My opponent has made his argument that we want to avoid a war with China. Well, we all know Taiwan wants to be independent. We all know they're basically independent. They're a free, democratic society. It's going to happen at some point. Now, a recent university poll in Taiwan has stated that over 78% of Taiwanese citizens would support independence, even if it meant a war. So if there's going to be independence, there's going to be a war, and Taiwan is fully capable and willing to fight it. What used to be a third world country, China is now the second largest economy in the world and a growing military power. China has pointed between 650 and 730 ballistic missiles toward China, towards Taiwan, China, and has also recently purchased 8 diesel power submarines. What is most telling about this Chinese military modernization is that China is not building. It is not building aircraft carriers, which it would need to operate effectively deploy its engagements far from China's shores. Instead, it is modernizing its forces to fight and win short, high-intensity conflicts along China's periphery. Namely, it is modernizing its capability of deterring U.S. Navy ships and the Su-30 fighters necessary to protect and strike Taiwan from the mainland. China does not need to outspend the U.S. and pose a clear threat to Taiwan. One Pentagon official stated that they only have to outspend the U.S. in the defense in the Pacific, and they are doing that. Over time, the balance of Taiwan equation is shifting out of our favor. Now is the time to act. Whether prospects for conflict in the near future are 2% or 50%, they're still high. Coinciding with China's military modernization aimed at coercing and potentially attacking Taiwan, China has acted to intervene in what would be a free and democratic Taiwan. To a great extent, Taiwan is economically dependent on China. China is Taiwan's largest exporting market, and 50% of Taiwan's investments go to China. China has used Taiwan's economic interdependence with China to influence Taiwan's internal politics. In August and September of this year, leading Taiwanese entrepreneurs who invest in China were invited to Beijing. At these meetings, Chinese officials demanded that if they funded pan-green candidates, they would receive barriers to future investments in China in return. China is putting pressure on Taiwan, and more visibly, in Taiwan's elections in 1996 and 2000, China threatened Taiwanese voters with military force if they picked pro-independent candidates. As China's military and economic growth continue, they will be more willing and more able to intervene and influence Chinese politics. Right now, the status quo is getting away from us. It is not sustainable. There will be a war at some point, whether we act now or whether we act in 50 years. Currently, China is buying over $2 billion worth of Russian equipment every year from Russia. These are planes, tanks, small arms. They're loading up their military. They're spending roughly $90 billion, according to recent DOD estimates, on their military. Do we want to wait and confront China on this extremely important issue now, or do we want to wait 50 years from now when they're much more harder to turn against U.S. military forces? On the economic front, U.S. Sino-trade rose from $5 billion in 1980 to $231 billion in 2004. China is growing as an economic power. It is the third largest trading partner with the United States. They're not going to threaten a war over, even if they do threaten a war over Taiwan, they're not going to win it. We can threaten sanctions, we can do what we want to resist the Chinese offensive in Taiwan. China is the world's fastest growing economies, and they're not going to neglect this just because of Taiwan. China pegs its currency to the U.S. because the economy relies heavily on the U.S. trade with China. As my opponent has said, they will put quotas on the U.S., but they're not going to. We are too important to China's economy. A U.S. out of Chinese economy would be detrimental to Chinese politics. Thank you.
First of all, a few responses. Our opponents have admitted that Taiwan today is free and prosperous. The question is, why change the status quo if Taiwan is free and prosperous today? Second, he spoke about China not building naval vessels. And I would say that that's correct. It's because they're buying naval vessels from the Russians, specifically Silvermany class destroyers, which everybody would say are directed at U.S. forces, essentially. It's directed at countering U.S. military dominance, naval dominance. I'm also not entirely certain that our opponents have met the burden of the resolution. If they rely on speeches, I don't think that that's a substantial increase in pressure. But let's deal with some of the specific arguments that they made. First of all, they talked about a moral obligation of freedom and democracy. And the question is a moral obligation for freedom and democracy enough for a country that already has both? We're talking about billions of dollars for a war. In Iraq and Afghanistan, for example, the current count is something like $200 billion. I think it's safe to say that a war with China would be far, far higher. We're talking about lives, American lives, the people next to you and behind you. In fact, one of my coworkers was in the Army. I certainly would not like to lose him over a country that is already democratic, free, and prosperous. Second, they talked about the economic issues. Our ties with Taiwan do, in fact, pale in comparison to our ties with China. But what I don't think they understand, and what I touched on in the cross-examination, is that China is willing to take far more damage on this, be it militarily or, in this case, economically, than we are, because it's simply that much more important to them. And finally, they talked about the status quo and about how it's untenable, how it hasn't worked. I would say that the status quo has worked. It's worked for the last 50 years with skillful diplomacy. Moreover, it works for both sides. Taiwan defines itself as independent and autonomous and acts as such. China calls Taiwan a part of the mainland and essentially operates that way. Deterrence has not failed with U.S. help, and I don't think that they have proven that that deterrence hasn't. Furthermore, we need Chinese cooperation in the United Nations, and I don't think that they dealt with that in their rebuttal. The United Nations has a veto power on the Security Council, which is extraordinarily important. In addition, they are a huge, huge actor in the six-party talks with North Korea over their nuclear ambitions. I think that we need China's regional significance in those talks, and I think that the actions that are suggested here would threaten that. Douglas MacArthur called Taiwan an unsinkable aircraft carrier, and the Chinese still feel that way today. They look at it as a threat, an American ally, a capitalist democracy off of their borders. They still see it as that unsinkable aircraft carrier. There are better ways to do this. There are better ways to achieve Taiwanese independence than provoking China in this direct a way. While some might sacrifice Hollywood, I don't think most Americans would trade LA for Taipei as a whole. We should not affirm this resolution because of the costs, Hollywood aside, are too high, and the benefit is this: new letterhead for Chinese government officials, and perhaps a new flag. And personally, I don't think that that letterhead and that flag are worth billions of dollars and thousands of lives.
We're now going to do a Q&A from the audience for 10 minutes. So if anyone has any questions, feel free to raise your hand, identify yourself, and ask your question to the negative or the affirmative.
And please identify your affiliation.
Yeah, Benjamin Adef from Johnson Institute. My question is for the gentleman of Cato Institute. You mentioned in your preliminary speech that the Americans don't want to sacrifice their lives, and their liberties to defend Taiwan. I just like to know how liberties could be sacrificed in war against China and Taiwan.
It's historically well known that with war, the state expands and liberties contract.
Within the borders of the state?
As opposed to what?
I mean, war expands abroad.
Of course, yeah. War is never, I'm not talking about civil war. I'm talking about things like the Patriot Act. I'm talking about things like civil liberties. It's in the Civil War, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. So it's, what is the name of the book?
If I could jump in quickly. Furthermore, I think the prospect of a draft, which is certainly a possibility when we're talking about the largest standing army in the world, that is a threat to civil liberties.
My name is Robin Schramm. I'm with the Cato Institute, and I was wondering, do you think that Taiwanese independence is worth the risk of a war with China?
No. And that's why I'm proposing economic and diplomatic pressures to avoid that war. I'm sorry I couldn't make myself more clear. So.
This question is for the negative side. You mentioned that, my name is Nick Wetzer from the Hudson Institute. Are you basically arguing that the United States should not intervene on the side of any ally if there is hostile aggression directed towards it? Because you said, it will suspend civil liberties, we shouldn't defend Taiwan. Yet, what if there was hostile action directed towards South Korea or Japan from China? At what point do you initiate warfare against another state if it's taking hostile aggression as a vote from your side?
Two things. We're not talking about South Korea. We're talking about Taiwan. Second, it's a cost-benefit analysis. So, I'd have to use the specific example, but basically it's a cost-benefit analysis, and it doesn't bear fruit with respect to Taiwan.
Furthermore, I think that the threat to liberty in South Korea is relatively small today. We've seen that the status quo has been able to protect their liberties, their democracy, and their capitalism for the last 50 years. And there, at least to me, is no indication that that's going to change in the immediate future, while I think that certainly would be different perhaps in other cases.
I'm going to quote you what I actually said. It was the third sentence. And yes, morality distinctly enters into the equation when death and destruction are very real factors.
I think that certainly enters into the cost-benefit analysis. And I think that the reason that it's mitigated here is that Taiwan is already free. We're not talking about a country that doesn't enjoy freedom today. I don't think that there's...
I just want to clarify what I was saying. I didn't make it clear. Lives, the death and destruction is a moral issue. It's not that morality has no issue. It's that people are going to get killed over this issue. And I think that's a moral question. So morality does enter into it, but not in the way our opponents would have you believe. It's, as I said, it's foreign policy, international relations. It's not about righteous abstractions and platitudes.
Jack from CSIS, this is for anybody who wants to answer it. A lot has been said about China's military buildup in this debate. And I guess the Pentagon came out and said a few months ago that China is spending roughly $90 billion on their military. But subsequently, the RAND study that was on China's military said that they're really only spending about $30 billion. Most of this is to replace antiquated equipment, and that's not... It's really not that significant. Does somebody want to address what China's military buildup really is and what it means?
Do you guys like to respond?
The thing about China's military buildup,
They say they spend $30 billion. The Pentagon says it's more like $90 billion. But then again, what they say they spend and what they actually spend might be the same thing and might not mean the same thing, because just like the Soviets, if you're paying your soldiers like $5 a year, it doesn't mean that you're not improving your military. And the Chinese in recent tests with the Russians have tested anti-carrier missiles, and as to the best of my knowledge, the only power that has carriers in the area is the United States, so I think we should be worried about that.
I would also say it's probably a lateral move, considering that Taiwan did not, at least in the most recent negotiations, purchase the $18 billion weapons package that the U.S. was offering them. So I think that the deterrence there is probably similar today.
Okay, 5 minutes of questions remaining.
Jason Mosley, the Cato Institute. My question is for the affirmative. There's been a lot of legitimate arguments about America spreading its military too thin with the war in Iraq, the war on terrorism. Does America have enough military substance to fight a third war? Would the American people support a third war?
You talk about this war as being a very long and protracted war. China, as from a lot of experts, does not have the military capability to actually invade Taiwan or to put significant troops on the ground. We're not talking about, you know, thousands of troops on either the Chinese side of the strait or the Taiwan. It would be a naval battle, air battle. So I don't think there's much of a problem of U.S. forces being spread too thin. I think we've got significant forces both out in sea right now and in reserve, and you know every military expert will tell you the same thing. Regarding the United States interest or the public interest in the third war, I think that fighting for independence of a country who's begging for it, I think the American people could easily find that acceptable if it comes to that.
Would you not consider that that same argument was used for Iraq, and now we have a president who's supported this war in Iraq, who has a popularity rating of about 40%?
This isn't part of the resolution. I'm not about to talk about Iraq.
All right. You had a question.
I was wondering, a lot was said about the growing military power of China, of course, growing economy. There's just growing global influence of China. Though obviously, they are sitting in Panama Canal. I'm wondering haven't all these facts really changed the strategic relevance of Taiwan?
Well, for them or for us? Well, I believe it made Taiwan all the more important. Since China is such a growing power, it is important not to have them also take Taiwan. And if I may also quote General MacArthur, who said that losing Formosa would be the most important strategic failure that the U.S. could do in the U.S. Pacific area.
And I am told we are actually out of time, so if we could have the judges make brief summarizing comments. And then,
now listen.
What?
I suppose I myself personally am struck by a couple of things. One is when you listen to the debates and the arguments, one is reminded of the truly variegated audience we have for political subjects here in the United States. And so much of this depends on what kind of an audience you're trying to persuade to believe what, or even more, to do what. And I suppose it would be interesting to conduct this debate in front of a cheering rally, where we were trying to do that, and or on the other hand, conduct this debate, let's say, in the presence of the President of the United States, where he was sort of listening, and where actually the opinion of the judge might matter in some in some real and existential sense. On the subject itself, I was, I guess I was speaking to Ralph Casa before about vague memories of this whole question when I was a boy in the 1950s. And it was then known as the Straits Crisis, perennial Straits Crisis, of which there may have been three, four, or five. And I remember President Eisenhower was president. Somehow he would say things about the Straits Crisis, and resolutions would be passed by the Congress. And Formosa was the name more commonly used for this place than Taiwan. It was hard to understand when you're small what this was all about. And so here it is with us again in some manner, shape, or form, despite all the enormous changes and other changes that have occurred in the world, and certainly the enormous changes that have occurred in China in the last generation. I don't know what that means, except to say that there's a certain obduracy and an obstinacy about these problems. And finally, I remember another utterance from around this period. I think it was about 1961. President Kennedy's first Secretary of State was Dean Rusk. He was interviewed and was asked whether he wanted to become known as the Secretary of State who had actually solved the Berlin problem. Some people will not know that there used to be a very serious problem in Berlin, although there is not one now. And Rusk thought about it. He said, well, I tell you, he said, I'd just as soon become another in the long line of secretaries of state who received the Berlin problem and passed it on intact to his successor. And sort of one hopes that if we can do at least this well on this problem, we will have accomplished something. But I'm really remarkably impressed by the degree to which all of the people who participated in this have learned a lot about it and thought about it and have tried, let me put this in a positive way, have tried to integrate the philosophical basis of the institutions in which they are interning and bring a lot of that to the discussion. So I thought it was really, for me, quite enjoyable and very, if I may say, educational.
Keep going.
Well, I'll try to be brief. I was very pleased with how the debate went, both this final round and the previous rounds. And it's always very impressive when people try to give a speech and then are forced the next round to give a speech defending the opposite thing that they just defended. And I thought people were very well prepared and seemed to have learned a lot about sort of the issues in the between China and Taiwan. And of course, certainly a relevant topic. With lots going on with the nation at war in Middle East. And I thought people touched on that enough without really getting bogged down inside issues, even though some of the questioners certainly would have liked that to have happened. I certainly enjoyed tonight.
I've heard three very good debates this evening, and I appreciate the efforts very much. My personal propensity is to say that adoption of this resolution by the U.S. government is unnecessary, counterproductive, and downright dangerous. It doesn't matter what I think. What matters is who did the best debating, and that's the way I've judged this throughout these three debates. Again, everybody did a great job. Congratulations.
Ditto all that.
Can I ask everybody to remain seated for one more minute, please? Before we announce the winners of tonight's debate, I'd like to welcome Mr. Ralph Casa to the podium. Mr. Casa is a member of the CSIS Board of Trustees and is president of the Pacific Forum of CSIS in Honolulu, Hawaii. Mr. Casa is an expert in the Pacific region and has significant experience working with China-Taiwan issue. Just this past week, the Pacific Forum hosted a conference on U.S.-Taiwanese relations. Without further ado, please help me in welcoming Mr. Ralph Casa.
Thank you. I think my primary job is to kill time while the folks add up their points and decide who the winner is. I would make as a general observation that when an individual, as many of these people did, can argue with equal passion both sides of the argument, they are in fact preparing themselves for life in Washington, D.C. So I, as somebody who lives in Honolulu, I both commend you and express my sympathies to you for that particular fact. I would say that this has been a stimulating evening, and I think that the real winner is everyone here. Anyone who has been sort of forced in the context of this to look at both sides of the argument, to be prepared to argue both sides, and also, and I think the real key thing, is to do it concisely. If I can tell you one piece of advice that will run contrary to everything that all of your professors tell you, our colleges don't prepare us fully for the real world, because what you learn, and as you get higher and higher, what your challenge is to take a small idea, and as an undergraduate, you stretch that into a 20-page paper. In a master's degree, you stretch it into 80 pages, and then for your PhD, you stretch it into about 300 pages. But the reality is, no one other than other graduate students read 300-page papers. What they read is 2 pages. If it's any more than 2 pages, they're not going to read it. So the ability to be able to hone your argument down into 3 minutes is key, because no one's going to listen to you for longer than 3 minutes. Now, I want to just make a couple of very quick comments. I thought the opening comments that you had this evening were very good, talking about the importance of debate. I would caution about one thing. I think the young lady said that you should debate foreign policy with your spouse. I'd go a little easy on that, quite honestly. Other than that, I thought there was a lot of very good advice that was thrown out. I feel compelled, as someone who sort of lives and breathes all of this stuff every day, to make a couple of other quick points. Number one, as was mentioned, I've actually run 2 conferences here in Washington in the last 2 days. One a closed-door meeting and the other a public seminar, both on U.S.-Taiwan relations. I can tell you that the same arguments that we heard tonight, we've been hearing over the same 2 days, not always as articulately. So I give all of the folks great credit. I learned some new facts, however, in the last 2 hours. And one of those was that the Chinese Navy is now superior to the U.S. Navy, particularly in submarines. This will come as a great shock to the U.S. Pacific Command commander, and I'm going to sort of rush back and tell him. In reality, the U.S. still has the most powerful submarine fleet in the world and the largest. The Russians are second. The problem with the Russians is that most of them are sinking. The third largest submarine fleet is actually owned by the Walt Disney Corporation, and then as you get further down, you finally get to the Chinese. A couple of real key points. One, President Bush never said that the U.S. will do what it takes to defend Taiwan. He said the U.S. will do whatever it takes to help Taiwan defend itself. This is a real important distinction, and I think that got lost in some of the debates, but in the real world, we should sort of remember that distinction. Back in 1995, no Chinese general ever said we are going to nuke Los Angeles, or that you wouldn't trade Los Angeles for Taipei. What actually occurred in that exchange was the Chinese general telling this American official that we are not afraid of your nuclear capability, because at the end of the day, you wouldn't swap Shanghai for Los Angeles. In other words, we don't worry about you conducting nuclear weapons against us because we have a deterrent. again, somewhat different. Now, we did have a giant Chinese general sort of fly off the handle a couple of months ago, a little bit more relevant, but completely sort of disregarded by the government itself. Beyond sort of those nitpicks, I think, again, wonderful debate. As was mentioned by Charles, a lot of the success of either one of the arguments would depend on the audience that you were giving it to. Quite honestly, in a congressional context, the affirmatives who argue more on a morality, on a sort of a principle basis, have a persuasive argument. When you go to the State Department, if you go to the NSC and the White House, then the three most important factors to be considered are U.S. national interests, U.S. national interests, and U.S. national interests. And then at the end of the day, that's sort of the question that you have to ask yourself, is how does this particular course of action improve or run contrary to U.S. national interests? And I think that's the real key to the debate, and the politics, the morality of it are important, but at the end of the day, you have to sort of say, how does it affect U.S. national security interests? I personally come down on the same side as Bill Taylor and others, but I welcome the debate on both sides. My very last point is that the one argument that disturbed me, not so much because I heard it a lot tonight, but because I hear it a lot, period, is the idea that war between the U.S. and China over Taiwan is inevitable, and therefore we might as well do it now while we have, while the odds are in our favor. If there's one thing that I can tell you is that that's what we're here for. That's what all of the institutes here are for. That's what the Pacific Forum and others are here for, is so that that statement, war is inevitable, proves to be the biggest false statement of the evening. And I don't believe it's inevitable. And I think that if we have these kind of debates and we examine the pros, the cons, and what's in the national security interest, and understand that the Chinese and the Taiwanese also debate what's in their national security interest, at the end of the day, no one believes that a war amongst the three of us is in anyone's national security interest. So I don't believe war is inevitable, and I think that if you do, that means you got to work harder where you are right now, because we have a responsibility in the think tank world to try to make sure that that's not true. So thank you very much.
And announce the winners. There are no losers in this thing that you've all been preparing for. The capability to debate is an enormous part of leadership. You get the ability to convince people to do something you want done because they want to do it. And you can make organizations do things. You can get people behind you to listen to you, to follow you. You're all winners. That's the only point I'm making. The way the numbers came out, Cato, 170, CSIS, 158. Congratulations to you all.
We'd like to say congratulations to all the teams, especially and to Cato for winning the championship round. We're just going to end tonight. There's a couple thank yous we must make because this event took some planning and a lot of people really helped out. So Leanna and myself, who work for the Abshire Inouye Leadership Academy here at CSIS, just wanted to give our thanks to some people. First for attending, we have Dolores Wharton, a CSIS trustee. She has done many things, including a lifelong career of encouraging young people to take on leadership roles and has really supported activities like this. And if you have anything to say, you could, or not.
I'll just speak very quickly. I think this evening, the opportunity to hear you and see you, just demonstrates how ingenious, what a really terrific idea it was to create this program. And Linda Jameson is to be warmly congratulated for... developing the curriculum and carrying it through. I started with CSIS about 10 years ago, and I was interested in the internship program. You were doing brown bag lunches in a conference center. That's what it amounted to. Now look what you're doing. It's exciting. You're developing your skills, and I really want you to know that you're needed. You're needed in world affairs. You're needed here in Washington especially, but certainly around the world. Keep up the good work.
I'd also like to thank Ralph Casa, our other CSIS trustee, for lending his expertise and thoughts tonight.
And I would like to thank you, Dr. Hamry and CSIS staff, for supporting this event, as well as Janet Granger, Jose Guzman, and their team who provide the wonderful food and the wonderful place.
We also like to thank CSIS's external relations team and Ken Kenworthy for recording the event. And as Dolores mentioned, Linda Jameson, the Dean of ALA, for ensuring the continuation and growth of these debate series.
And of course, if this tonight will not happen without the participation of the debaters itself, the coaches and the judges from the participating institution, we would like to especially thank Christopher Prable from Cato, Lynn Gibson of the Heritage Foundation, and Richard Waits of the Hudson Institution. And last but not least is we would like to thank you, our CSIS volunteers, Vicky Palomo, George Farfer, Jason Kyber, Brian Patrick, Greg Sanders, and Mr. Bill Taylor. Thank you again, and good night.
Yes, good night.